welcome to Unjustly Maligned, the show for people who go against the grain. We seek to rehabilitate the overlooked, ignored, derided, or the just plain hated. Movies, novels, music, comic books, video games, whatever. If everyone hates it, we will find someone who loves it and let them explain why you should too. I'm your host, Anthony Johnston, and my guest today is the software engineer, Jonathan Penn. Jonathan, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Anthony.
And this is our 4th of July episode. That's the date it'll be published. Anyway, if you're listening in the future, it was published on 4th of July. And so we thought, what could be more American than Big Blue himself? So, Jonathan, please tell us what you've come on the show to talk about, some context around it, its release, its reception, why it is generally maligned, and why you think that that is wrong.
We're going to talk about the movie Superman 3, and Superman is the quintessential American superhero born out of the Great Depression, and Jerry Siegel created the character as part of like trying to imagine the ideals of humanity and thinking ahead. You know, whenever people talk about Superman, they usually drop their German Übermensch, and then they start, you know, getting all intelligent and flowery. And that starts a conversation about how Superman is supposed to be beyond what humanity has reached and our aspirations. But it's just interesting because Superman is, at its core, an immigration story about a space alien that comes to land on Earth, integrating into American society, joining in a small farming culture in the American Midwest. And then he kind of takes on the characteristics and the values of that society. And as he grows up, he learns about his high culture back on Krypton. And then just kind of this merger of the two cultures as he grows up. And then he tries to take on the American ideals and becomes part of this mythos of American individualism and, you know, truth, justice, the American way, and all that stuff. So it's interesting how it all kind of formed and started in this environment. And then, it started out as a comic book, which I have to confess, I have not actually read many of the Superman comic books. And I know this is more of your purview, so you can speak more to that if you have feedback on that. My exposure to Superman has been through the television and film. I first got introduced to it through the old fashioned TV shows that my dad really enjoyed. And then got involved into it with the movie directed by Richard Donner and starring Christopher Reeve. And then the second movie came out. It was half directed by Christopher Donner, or by Richard Donner. And then the other half of it was directed by Richard Lester. And then the third Superman movie, which is the one that I feel is unjustly maligned, was fully directed by Richard Lester. And that is actually a large part of the reason this movie is unjustly maligned, is because it doesn't have Richard Donner at the helm. A lot of people feel that it kind of lost its way, that the first Superman movie had a lot of weight attached to it. They wanted to make you believe that a man could fly, is how they put it. And so when they tried to put together the movie, it was very deep, and it had a slow pacing and a very majestic backstory. And when the first movie was released, it was a big hit, but the production schedule took so long to complete. They tried to do the first and second movies together at the same time, which was kind of unheard of back then. It happens a lot nowadays, but back then that was a big deal. And they were running so far behind that they ended up picking a different director to do the rest of the second movie, and then he ended up going on to do the third movie as well. And so a lot of people feel like Richard Donner got the short end of the stick, didn't get a chance to complete his vision with the first movie. And so the second director that they picked kind of gets becomes the butt of all the jokes, and he ruined the franchise and all this stuff. So there's a lot of that turns, you know, that makes this movie have such a negative vibe in the culture. That said, I think there are some valid reasons why the third movie is not as good as the first or the second movie. It's a little more campy. There are some
just
things
a little.
Yeah. I am not going to try to defend it and say it is a better movie. Please don't get me wrong on that. But I think though that it, as a continuation of the film aspect of Superman, it still is interesting. There are some parts of it that I find fascinating, that I think advance the story in a unique way, and that's why I'm here to defend it.
Yeah, and you're right about the sort of going back to the roots. I mean, what could be more American than an immigrant story? Which, as you say, is really what Superman is, you know, land of immigrants. And here is the ultimate immigrant who comes to represent sort of the ultimate values of America, which is, you know, when you put it like that, it sounds kind of cheesy. But back in the 30s, when he was conceived, that wasn't necessarily such a hackneyed idea. You know, and you could even argue that it's only become hackneyed because of a figure like Superman over the years.
Yeah. Yeah. And in many ways, the people's reaction to a space alien was kind of banal. I mean, when you think of other science fiction stories, a space alien coming to Earth is kind of a big deal and a little terrifying. It upsets our whole world. But a lot of the Superman story, it's almost treated as like, oh, really? Well, at least he's a nice guy. And it's he's lucky he looks like a well-built white man.
Yes. I mean, really convenient.
I know. Yeah, if he was shorter, a little greener, whatever, you know, who knows, he may not have been received well. And I mean, you know, I'm not here to comment necessarily on the new Superman remakes that Zack Snyder has done, but one of the things that I find interesting about it is how he's treated more like an alien. So it's interesting to see that shift. He wasn't seen as an alien when this was first created, because he was meant to be more of this aspirational ideal of what Americans thought of themselves.
Right. Well, and he definitely isn't treated like an alien in this movie series, in which, yes, I mean, he looks as he does in the comics, and he is just sort of a well-built, handsome white man. But also just the way he's treated and the reactions to him, apart from in the first movie, with Lex Luthor's diabolical hatred of Superman and what have you. And even then, you know, in this movie versions, it's not even driven by much of a hatred of Superman, just that Superman is foiling Lex's plans. So yeah, the emphasis on him being an alien, even in the first couple of movies with the Fortress of Solitude and, you know, General Zod and all that, it's still not really heavily emphasized. And by this movie, there's practically no mention of it at all, other than as a plot device to, you know, sort of give him the infected kryptonite halfway through.
Yeah. Yeah. He's accepted as one of our own really quickly.
Yeah. Very quickly. Yeah. Yeah. I was 6 years old when the first Superman movie came out, the first of the Superman with Christopher Reeve movies, and I loved it. I actually, you said that the comics is more my wheelhouse, and generally yes, but I'm not a huge Superman reader, and actually I'm not sure if I'd ever read any Superman before that first movie came out. I think after that I may have bugged my parents for, you know, some Superman comics down at the local store, but I'm not actually sure if I'd read any before then. So I was only 6 years old, so it's hard to remember. But certainly, as a result, growing up, Christopher Reeve's version, this version of Superman, is inextricably linked in my mind to the idea of Superman, very much so, to the point where just watching this movie again in preparation for the show, I hadn't seen it for a long time. I saw it when it came out, and I remember enjoying it, but also, yes, that it was thinking that it was a bit goofy. But I hadn't seen it for ages before watching it in preparation for the show, and literally just seeing Christopher Reeve, even when he's dressed as Clark Kent, let alone when he puts on the Superman outfit, just brings out this sort of, you know, very heavy, nostalgic feelings for me, you know, feelings of sort of, oh, wow, yeah, he's great, because I grew up with him as Superman.
So did you enjoy the movie?
Well, when I was a kid, I thought it was good. I didn't think it was as good as the others because it wasn't quite as serious. It was a little campy, as you say. But yeah, rewatching it, I'm much more sort of aware of and able to spot the flaws now as an adult, obviously. But yeah, overall, I still enjoyed it. It made me laugh in the right places. I still think that the evil Superman stuff is brilliant and a tour de force of acting from Reeve. And the stuff, the one thing that always stuck with me about this movie, apart from the evil Superman stuff, is the robotification of Vera at the end by the supercomputer. That sent the willies up me when I was a kid. And even watching it now, it still got to me. I was like, whoa, that's pretty horrible. Even though it's completely absurd and impossible, it's just, I don't know, it's just quite well done.
Oh, my brother and I had this tradition where when we watch movies, our couch was out away from the wall, and we would jump behind the couch at all these scenes that were terrifying. And this was always the one. It was like, oh, that was very, very visceral.
Well, that was our tradition over here with Doctor Who. That's the joke about Doctor Who over here, was that the kids would hide behind the sofa, you know, and peek out when it, something scary wasn't happening. But yeah, it was. It wasn't as well received as the first two movies. And part of that was, both critically and commercially, and part of that was apparently just because it was out and out funny, you know, not just, I mean, you're right that it was a little campy, but that camp was done in the service of making it basically a comedy. It's a superhero comedy movie, much more so than the first two.
Yeah, there's a lot more action than at least the first one. The second movie, at least as it was finished and released theatrically, had more action scenes than the first movie. But this one was kind of done. I mean, Richard Lester, who directed this one, he tends to do more funny things. It's kind of his shtick. And so he wanted to make this more appealing to a wider audience. He's thinking children too. Like, oh, well, the whole movie starts with that strange Rube Goldberg slapstick maneuvers all throughout the scene. Yeah. I mean, for people who, as a child, when I first saw this, it didn't bother me. But even now I can imagine, the first two movies started out in space on Krypton. They kind of had this real high view of the scope of the story. And then now we're like watching burning penguins rolling around the city of Metropolis. It's really, it was really odd way to start the movie.
And it takes over 6 minutes of time. 6 minutes of screen time is devoted to that slapstick sequence. And we do see a couple of, you know, our regular characters. Like, we see Clark Kent, we see Jimmy Olsen, and we see, I can't even remember her name, but the character that Pamela Stevenson plays. But for no real reason, you know, it's not relevant to the story in any way at all. It's crazy.
Yeah, that is a bit unfortunate. At least like the very beginning when Gus is trying to get his, you know, get his on his feet. At least that scene sets the stage in terms of like, okay, well, this is a character that's going to be played all the way through. But yeah, that part was kind of strange. And that part in the middle when Gus is hacking into the computers to try to talk to this weather satellite, which we'll talk about the technology problems here in a moment. Yeah, I have a lot of thoughts about that. But this, you know, that moment when the whole world starts falling apart and all these things happen, and then the two the don't walk and the walk signs like start getting in and fighting with each other. Yeah. Up to that point in the movie, it did feel like there was a certain set of rules that were being followed, and then it all just kind of fell apart at that point. Like, what?
Right.
How is this even possible? I don't understand this.
Yeah, exactly. At that point, you're like, okay, then now they are just going for the laughs. Well, that and the, and actually that might come before this bit, but also the bit where Richard Pryor falls off the roof of the building and then lands on the glass roof on his skis and sort of, you know, skis off into the road. And like, that's solid. That's a solid glass roof that he lands on. It doesn't matter that it's broken his fall from the sidewalk. It's still 40 stories down. He would still break his legs.
No, it was slanted. There's got to be something there that would help, you know.
Or maybe he'd only break one leg.
Yeah, that is in everything. I was doing some scanning of the internet, trying to find the most frustrated comments about this movie, and that scene right there, where Gus is skiing off the top of a skyscraper in Metropolis, everyone's like, "What is going on?"
Yeah,
they just can't. They can't defend. There's nothing to defend about that, and I won't even try.
That would be pretty hard to defend. Yeah. I do. I mean, talking about the technology, one of the things I do like is that there is And they could get away with this, obviously, in 1983, because computers were such, in terms of the mainstream, computers were still practically, you know, this mysterious black box of wizardry. Home computers were still very rare. The ones that existed were mostly used for games by kids. You know, as we saw again later in the movie when they have that weird video game sequence. And so a lot of the technology stuff, I mean, is obviously unrealistic, but is also just, they don't even really attempt to explain it. They just go, hey, because computers.
And oh, these computers are amazing. We don't even have this technology now. Like weather satellites that can alter the weather. That's, yeah. that didn't come until Back to the Future 2.
and the weather satellites got lasers built into it. Why?
Oh, and spectrometers. They can analyze things in other solar systems. And this is fantastic. Yeah.
In the galaxy next door or something. Yeah. Oh man. But all of that does, however, and I mean, yes, it's absurd, but one of the things it does do is it contributes to some good, well-paced storytelling, which is that they don't get bogged down, which a lot of modern movies do. They don't get bogged down in trying to explain stuff that doesn't actually need to be explained for you to get the point of the movie. Like the fact that Gus discovers he's a computer savant. That whole scene is like 30 seconds. You know, and it's like, oh, it turns out I'm a computer genius. Okay, great. That's going to be important, but we don't actually need to focus on it. It's just part of the setup. So let's move on.
Good Lord. How did you do that?
I don't know. I just did it.
Yeah, I think one of the things I liked about this is that you really don't know what's going to happen. A lot of these movies kind of set things up and you kind of, a lot of the goofy comedy movies, even in this era, they set things up in a way that you can kind of tell where it's going to go, but you have no idea. You know, what is he going to, when he pulls out those scraps of paper from his pocket, when he starts to make the demands in front of the, you know, the villain Webster, and he starts to say, you know, I want a cut. And Webster says, all right, well, what do you want? And he starts pulling out these scraps of paper out of his pocket and they look confused too. Like, what are you trying to do? And he says, I want to build this super, super computer that can do anything, you know, and anything you tell me to tell it to do. It's when you realize that, yeah, okay, well, this character plays a really important part in where the story's going to go.
Yeah, and by the way, this supercomputer complex also has ballistic missile silos and, you know, some weird, strange guided missile, super missile as a backup, and lasers, of course, it's got lasers, and just... Like, what?
It's not just a computer. It's a fortress that has machine learning and all this stuff. It's
right, yeah. Very advanced machine learning at that.
I mean, and you can turn it off and it still finds power. So...
Yes, by magically drawing it from power lines overhead through the air. But, I mean, this is what I mean. All of this stuff is... I mean, you're into the realms of fantasy by the end of the movie. And actually, I mean, of course, it's a Superman movie, so... You know, you can argue the whole thing is a fantasy. Of course it is. But, and I have mentioned this before, you know, I always feel there's one big thing that you can ask an audience to accept. And then beyond that, you know, to an extent, you have to kind of stay within fairly realistic bounds. So obviously with the Superman movies, that big concept, that big leap is like, okay, Superman exists. Now, you know, take that as read. And we'll play fair for the rest of the movie. But they kind of don't in this one. The whole movie turns into just outright fantasy by the end. But I do remember as a kid not caring. I genuinely did not care about how... And I knew even as a kid that a lot of this was just technically rubbish. You know, absolute nonsense. But I didn't care because I was thoroughly entertained. And that's one of the things about what I was saying about them not sort of feeling they need to explain too much. There's a lot in this movie. It's 2 hours. There is a lot of story. There are a lot of scenes. And it all kind of rattles along at a really, really good clip.
Yeah. And it captures, in the midst of all the fantasy and the strange things that are happening, it captures an interesting moment in time when technology was becoming more prevalent. Like the fact that he gets a paycheck that's not as big as he wants. And so he figures out, oh, I can just take the rounding errors and make a larger paycheck. And then he gets more money. And then the other scene where they show a person receiving a bill and it has this huge number at the end. It's like they're misbilled for hundreds of thousands of dollars and traffic lights don't quite work right. There's this general sense of like the world is not in our control. There's this unintelligible organism of some kind, and it feels like we're just kind of being washed around by things. And the whole movie has that theme. Technology is magical, but also kind of like, well, we don't really know what we are doing with it. In the end, we're just kind of like, you know, having fun. We built this big complex with missiles, and then it turns on us, and it turns someone into a robot, and it just turns all this stuff. It's an interesting phenomenon, kind of moving into a dystopian world from our conveniences that turn against us.
Right. Yeah. There are so many stories now. I mean, you know, these days, especially, it's practically a genre unto itself, isn't it?
Technology.
We build technology to help us, and then it runs amok and takes over, and suddenly it's our worst nightmare. And I mean, not that this is the first instance of that, but it wasn't anywhere near as common, simply because we didn't know, you know, that much about computers and technology at this time, which I think is reflected in the ridiculous things that the computers are able to do.
It's one of the, being a software programmer, I often look at movies with a very critical eye about that particular thing, you know, as people do with their own interests. And, but this movie, you can't even try. Like, it's from the very beginning, the whole thing is like, well, we know where this is going. They're not even trying to look realistic. And that's okay. Their goal was to communicate a feeling, and, you know, marked within the time that they were in and stuff like that. It still serves the story really well.
Absolutely. And I was going to ask you about that. Yeah, obviously being a software engineer, but also, so when did you first see this movie?
So it was after, I don't think it was in 83, because I think I remember seeing this after I saw Ghostbusters, which was in 84. And again, as far as comedies go, this was that whole era when people were like making funny movies, and someone said we should get Richard Pryor in this movie because we need a comedian to be a foil for Superman. And then turns out he's not necessarily a bad guy. And so I saw it probably in 85 or 86. And then, I was interested in technology at a very young age, you know, reading lots of hard science fiction and getting into computer programming. So for me too, watching this, I began to feel like even at a very young age, this is totally outrageous. But I was also a fan of watching the Star Trek TV show, which also had a lot of outrageous things too. And, you know, you kind of hand wave over all these inconsistencies, but that's okay. You know, it's just the way it is.
So had you seen the first two Superman movies before you saw this?
I did. We watched them. I didn't see them in the theater, but when they came out and when I was old enough, my parents said, hey, we should watch these movies. And so we pretty much watched them back to back, at least as far as I can remember. And I remember thinking I loved the three supervillains. There was something terrifying about that. And so the second movie was my favorite until I got a little older and realized it was not paced as well as the first one.
Yeah. I had pretty much the same thing, actually. For years, I thought that Superman 2 was a better movie until I then rewatched them as an adult and was like, oh, no, actually, no, Superman 1 is better.
Sometimes with backstories, you have flashbacks to try to help communicate, oh, this happened in the past and set up our character to be blah, 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 you know, whatever. I liked the way they went back to Clark's upbringing by visiting Smallville, and then he met Lana again. And then you kind of realized, oh, there was this kind of hidden romance going on where he didn't feel comfortable talking to her and she was busy doing her own thing and didn't notice him. And we then see Brad, and we kind of get this feel that, oh yeah, he was involved in the high school there, and people knew him. And there's kind of this sense where you get this picture of his life as he was growing up in rural America before he became, you know, the Metropolis reporter, and then understood his own identity as Superman. And I liked that a lot. I mean, there were some, of course, there's some cheesy parts the way it unfolded. The rescue scene in the field was there mainly to make a reason to bring Superman into the town.
Yep.
But the idea was that, hey, Smallville this was his world. And we're kind of seeing remnants of that in this scene.
Well, and I thought the relationship between him and Lana was also quite well portrayed by Christopher Reeve and Annette O'Toole, who, in case people hadn't realised, Annette O'Toole, who plays Lana Lang in this, is the same actor, the same Annette O'Toole, who plays Martha Kent on Smallville.
Right.
Like, plays Clark's mother, which is just so bizarre. I still have trouble wrapping my head around that one. But I thought the relationship between them was, I thought those two actors did a really good job because they didn't have a lot of time to, you know, to sort of get that across. And I thought they did it really, really well. It wasn't cloying and it didn't feel contrived. It felt, you know, it looked and felt natural.
Yeah. And her transformation of being someone who realized, you know, what am I doing with my life? I need to try to go do something. Not that there's nothing you can't do in a small town, but, you know, for where she was at, she was feeling drawn to something, and then interacting with Clark made her think, you know, I should move to Metropolis. And so it was interesting to see her kind of change in the process as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, there is a possibly apocryphal story that the whole reason that they have him going back to Smallville and that Lana Lang is basically the co-star of the movie rather than Lois Lane is because Margot Kidder badmouthed the producers for getting rid of Richard Donner. And so they sort of, you know, wrote her only a tiny part in this movie.
Lois, are you going someplace?
Well, Clark, you know, some people get to go all the way to Smallville, and then there are others of us who have to go to Bermuda.
Golly.
Bye. Bye. Bye.
I don't know if that's necessarily true, because the rest of the Smallville stuff does feel quite logical. As you say, it makes sense, and it's a good way of showing, well, of making some of the sort of moving parts of the movie make sense, but also, yeah, showing Clark's, you know, the effect that Small Town had on him and showing his personality in Metropolis compared to what he was like in high school. It's a really good device. So I don't know whether that's necessarily true, but it is one sort of theory that's floating out there.
Yeah, I mean, given a lot of the frustrations and the fact that they did change directors midstream in that second movie, it probably has some. there were a lot of tension, a lot of high strung tension going on there. So.
Well, and I believe Richard Pryor as well was approached by the producers for this movie because he publicly said that he loved Superman 2. And I think they maybe knew that they wanted to go in a lighthearted direction, and so that's why they approached him specifically to, you know, to be the sort of the second string, if you like, the foil to Superman in this particular movie, because yeah, he'd said that he absolutely loved Superman 2. And of course the flavor of this movie is nothing like Superman 2. So
not at all. I liked Richard Pryor in the movie. I mean, there were parts where he was really over the top, and of course the skiing scene. But there were some things where he had these little minor quips and comebacks that were kind of like, oh yeah, this is kind of like what a guy who doesn't know what he's doing, you're trying to figure out what he's doing with his life, is kind of how I'd imagine, you know, someone would play out. And he turns out to be a really suave confidence man, boldly breaking into a little computer shop, you know, convincing a guy, hey, you know, you need me to come in here and I'm going to access your machines. And then even like trying to act like an armed forces officer.
Yeah, the general, yeah.
Yeah, he's a man of many talents. It's interesting to see this come out. And I thought his character was funny to watch. There were some definite things that I enjoyed about it.
Yeah, he was. I mean, that's the thing. Like I say, for all the ills of this movie, and it, you know, it has its flaws, absolutely. But it is entertaining, and a large part of that is that Richard Pryor is just funny. He is funny to watch in this movie. He has some great lines. He delivers them well. You know, he fully commits to a kind of ridiculous role and some very ridiculous scenes. And yeah, he's just good and he's funny. He was absolutely worth, you know, if this is the kind of movie they wanted to make, he clearly was the man for the job.
And I think he and all the other actors, there's good chemistry going on between everybody too. It didn't feel like... Like, I'm sure there was an upper level management decision saying we need a comedian in the movie, but at least they picked someone who worked well, and everyone enjoyed working with him, and it seemed that way on the set.
It certainly, yeah. I mean, that that's the impression you get watching the movie. Who knows behind the scenes, but certainly, yeah, they all have good chemistry and they all work well together in those scenes. But, you know, again, this is early 80s, so it's quite a long time ago now. And, you know, maybe also it was just down to a bit of professionalism. Because this isn't that long after, you know, people still used to have massive golden handcuff studio contracts. And you would just make whatever movies the studios told you to. and I think that comes across a little in the story and the way the movie is sort of told as well. And the storytelling, the nuts and bolts of it. Because one of the things that did impress me about this movie, much more so actually than Superman 2, not so much Superman 1, because Superman 1 is very good in this respect, but it is, everything fits together. There is nothing extraneous or wasted. Either something is ephemeral and is set up and then paid off pretty much immediately, like the whole salami slicing thing with his wages, or it ties into something that will come up later on in the movie, and you know that it will all connect together, like, you know, the
Chekhov's acid,
right? Yeah. Yeah, the acid is exactly, that's the first sort of note I made about this. Yeah, right at the start you've got that thing about the acid that is volatile when it overheats, and even things like the premise of getting Lana to go to Metropolis so that she's on the subway when the power goes down. And, I mean, there are many movies that would do more with that and would then have Superman having to save a runaway subway train with her on it or something. But just the mere fact that her and her son are there in Metropolis, you know, it all just kind of, it all ties up. And as you say, yes, there's the acid, there's the way that they get Gus into, in league with Webster. It's all just kind of, it all fits together really, really well. There's no loose ends and nothing left sort of hanging, making you think, wait a second, what about such and such? Which feels like quite a sort of old fashioned way of making movies now.
Sounds retro, I guess.
But it, yeah, it's all very tightly interwoven, even though so much of it is just absurd. And I mean, that's the thing, as an adult now, software engineer, you know, how do you get over sort of rewatching so much ridiculous technology?
I prepare myself with Doctor Who, and then I sit down to watch the show. I'm a huge fan of the original, the older Doctor Who series as well. You know, with outrageous costumes and all this good stuff. Yeah, I don't know. I think, as a software developer, I like to think of doing things the right way, because, you know, we want to make these tools help us do things better. But there's also a part of me that loves to see how people perceive these things. And so when I look at this movie, and they think it's wizardry, this is how it looked, and this is what they put in the show. And this guy, oh yeah, learning how to be a computer genius, you just, all you got to do is have a quick moment of self-discovery looking at the back of a matchbook. And then you sit down in the machine, you start typing. I'm not as necessarily turned off by the technological gaffes as much as just thinking this is part of, it's like a snapshot in the mind of what people imagine technology being, including the parts of the uncontrollable parts and the unintelligible parts. You know, there's a lot of people concerned today about, well, as machine learning gets more and more involved and more accurate, and as machines grow in their understanding of things, what happens if we end up figuring out how to create, or an intelligence emerges out of all this? You know, what do we do? Well, I mean, in many ways, bureaucracy is kind of like that now. You know, it's an unintelligible organism that kind of controls your life. You know, this isn't something that humanity hasn't really faced before, but that feeling of like, I don't really understand what's happening, and then it's, you know, it's going to fight back. I like watching that portrayed, because I think it keeps us humble. It's kind of like what happened when Gus thinks, I'm just going to build this machine. You know, here's all my plans. I want to, of course, missiles. Why not tie it into the defense grid? You know, what could possibly go wrong? You know, having these kinds of stories, even my kids, we were sat down to watch this together and they're like, this is not a good idea. They're 6 and 8. Of course, they know that we talk about this too. Like, you know, as we have these tools that become more, more efficient at executing our commands, well, let's be careful with what we tell them. You know, that whole phenomenon is interesting to see. And people are much more aware of this, and you know, even self-aware of their own interaction with technology today. But at that time in 1983, it's fascinating to me.
It really was an interesting time, and this was only a couple of years after Tron, of course.
Yes,
which you know had an even more absurd.
I wanted to go in there.
Oh, so did I. So did I. Believe me, but had an even more absurd and fantastical approach to technology. I believe this was also around the time, this is a very, very much a segue now, but 84, I think, was when the TV show Whiz Kids premiered. You may be too young to remember that, but Whiz Kids was a sort of an A-team sort of action procedural type, you know, Saturday primetime show about a bunch of kids. I think it was actually came off the back of War Games. The success of War Games. And it was about a bunch of kids who were like computer hackers. And they were the same. They could do anything with computers. It was just magical.
I think I recognize that premise. I was just becoming sentient around that time. So,
right.
War Games is another good one. Yeah, that's
right. That's, I mean, but War Games is a legit, I mean, that, you know, War Games will probably never be on this show because it is a legitimately great movie. I don't think anybody really maligns War Games. That said, the technology in it, although it's presented more seriously, isn't actually that much more feasible than most of what early 80s movies presented as, you know, computer technology. It's still pretty far from the truth.
Yeah, which is fine. I mean, we do that with physics, we do that with chemistry, with genetics. I mean, we use these things in service of larger stories to explore other things, you know. So it's, yeah.
That's true, actually. Yeah. So why should computers get a pass just because we do actually happen to, more people happen to know how computers really work now?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and maybe part of the problem is a lot of the people going into working with computers tend to be hyper analytical. So they, I mean, I would put myself in this camp. You pick things apart, and when it's not quite right or when it's not representing what you know, it's, hey, wait a minute. You know, that is kind of a standard human thing in a lot of ways.
That's true, but you're right. The sort of people who are drawn to be software engineers and developers are generally also, yes, because of the mindset you need to have to work in that field, I think. You know, I think they're sort of, no, I wouldn't say inextricably linked, but there is a very, very strong connection there, I think.
At least traditionally, that's kind of been the way it's been perceived. So we need more artists and painters in the computer software industry. So we'll see how that goes.
Well, that's true. And actually, that's a good link too. We need to talk about the evil Superman fight scene,
yes,
which is just sheer fantasy. I mean, that's whole, you could even argue that the whole scene takes place inside Superman's head, where he splits apart into, you know, the evil Superman and the good Clark Kent personalities, and they fight in a scrapyard.
Yeah, that to me is my favorite part. It was when I first saw the movie, it was the only thing I remembered. And when I sat down to watch it a couple of years later, I kept wondering, well, where's that scene? I kept waiting for that one scene to come up, and I forgot about all the rest. Because there's something about that has this, it was really well done. Christopher Reeves did a fantastic job playing both sides. I saw a making of documentary, and there he is in the junkyard dressed as Superman, and then there he is dressed as Clark Kent, and he's basically just going back and forth, you know. And they, of course, they cut it that way, but he's trying to play the character, and it's really fascinating to see how that plays out, I really like how it was part of this transformation. He slowly becomes more and more grumpy. I don't know how else to describe it. Yeah, he's not even really evil. He's easily teased, and he says, oh, why don't you go, you know, punch a hole in that oil tanker? Okay. You know, he's more selfish than anything. And the part when he's snapping at the peanuts in the bar and like breaking the bottles, there was something about that always gave me this terrifying sense of, wow, he can turn anything into a weapon, this is what I would have imagined people would have thought of. He's a space alien, super powerful alien. Like, what? This is when people are starting to wonder what's going on. You know, who cares about the Leaning Tower of Pisa? You know, this is an all powerful creature who he's capricious. He's lost any sense of like what I'm at least earnestness or like I want to do the right thing. It's all gone now. And so by the time he reaches the junkyard and he's going through this internal struggle, it's you're right there because it, you know, it's and it's funny that Clark can't fly and Clark wears his glasses and that plays this interesting dichotomy. You know, the secret identity kind of represents this good side and the superhero part of him represents this powerful side and he's kind of drunk with power and then yeah, they have to fight it out and then it you think it's all done when the Superman, the bad Superman character crushes Clark's glasses. And then I don't know why they both thought that using these junkyard machines would actually work on each other. That doesn't seem to make any sense, but I'll give that a pass. But
they're not thinking straight.
Yeah. Well, and I actually hadn't thought of it that way, but you're right. This probably all happened in his mind. This is all part of like, it's an internal battle that he has. And then, you know, Clark finally bursts out and chokes the bad Superman. And then he pulls open his shirt and you see the Superman costume underneath it. It really, the whole thing has this symbolic sense of like, of wrestling with selfish desires versus, you know, some sort of earnest desires and wanting to, you know, at least as Superman has been aspirationally designed, you know, representing the, you know, the truth and justice and all this stuff. Like he's wrestling with what all that means at that point. Brought about by tar in kryptonite, you know, they need some sort of, you know, thing to make that happen. But yeah, it was really fascinating.
Yeah, it really is the sort of wrestling within the demons, you know, the dark side that we all have within us. And I think that's, you know, that's the lovely part about how symbolic it is. The idea that everyone, even the best of us, and as you know, as we said earlier, the whole point of Superman is that he is the best of us. Or at least the modern incarnation, you know, how we think about Superman now is that he is the best, the most upstanding, the most moral, honorable, truthful, you know, justice advocate that you could imagine. He is the best of mankind. And even he has this dark side that can manifest and that has to be defeated in a scrapyard. but symbolically it's really interesting. And the fanfare, when he finishes and pulls open the shirt to reveal the real Superman outfit, not the horrible dark dingy colored Superman outfit that evil Superman wears, and you get the fanfare as you zoom in on the Superman S. It's cheesy as all hell, but it gets you. It works, man. You know, that is, it's so perfectly staged because the fight as well is kind of brutal. You know, it really is, as you say, like you're throwing him in crushes and stuff, and it's really quite brutal and then literally throttles evil Superman to death. And then suddenly a ray of light, the shirt comes off, zoom in on the S, get the Superman, the John Williams fanfare. And it really gets you, you know, hairs on the back of your neck go up and it's like, yeah, you know, this has been a victory for sort of, you know, truth and morality. It's great. And Christopher Reeve is amazing in that scene, as you say, just plays both sides so well. I thought he just played evil Superman. As you say, he's not really evil, more just kind of a dick. But, you know, he played douchebag Superman really, really well, you know, given that and up until that point, Christopher Reeve was not an actor. You know, most people only knew him as Superman. You know, he'd never played as far as most people were concerned, they'd never seen him play anything other than either a bumbling do-gooder, i.e. Clark Kent, or Superman, for heaven's sake. And so to pull that off and be convincing at the same time, you know, really, again, speaks to his talent as an actor.
They got lucky because he, like in the first movie, when they went to go find the cast, that they needed something that would bring weight. So they hired Marlon Brando to play Jor-El, Superman's father. And they basically spent most of their budget on him.
Yep.
And then they got Gene Hackman, you know, another huge chunk of their budget. And then they're like, well, We got to find somebody. And yeah, Christopher had done a Broadway and other thing in theater. And so he had experience, but he wasn't a star in that sense. So this was kind of his chance to really show off to a very large audience.
Yeah, there was, I don't remember where it was, but there was an article I read actually about the casting of Christopher Reeve as Superman not so long ago. And I seem to recall that in this article, they said that he didn't even regularly work out much when he went to do the audition. He was kind of, I mean, he was obviously very tall, but he was kind of skinny and wimpish. And, you know, they just looked at him and went, you've got to be kidding. But he convinced them, you know, with his sort of just character acting ability, and then hit the gym like nobody had ever hit the gym before.
I was reading, there's a book actually about the making of the Superman movies. Up to the point when the first Superman movie was released. And in there, they were talking about how they had to have matte paintings made to know where Superman was going to be able to paint things in. And the problem was Christopher was bulking up so fast, they had to keep changing these stand-in stencils.
Oh, wow, really?
Yeah, through the course of production, he was just getting bigger and bigger. I mean, and suddenly he kind of like was a little Superman, you know, exceeding what he thought he could do before.
He just looks so good in the part as well.
Oh, yeah.
And it helps that he, you know, bulked up and everything. But facially, he's got that beautiful square jaw. You know, at some points his neck is actually thicker than his jawline. And his jawline's pretty impressive. You know, that lovely aquiline nose. And yeah, he just looks... But this is what I mean. I am so biased because I grew up with him as my Superman, as it were. So he will always, to my mind, be how I picture Superman, you know?
Yeah, same here. It made it hard watching a different actor in the more recent movies that have come out. But
talking about the modern movies, can I just take a moment to point out there is a certain irony that when he becomes douchebag Superman in this movie, his costume gets progressively darker in color. The red becomes sort of maroon and then almost brown. The blue becomes deeper and deeper and darker. And, you know, there's more and more black in it until, you know, finally the fight in the junkyard. There is a certain irony that those colors are the colors that they now use for regular Superman, like in the modern movies. I will leave it to the audience to, you know, to decide what that says about the modern incarnation of Superman in the movies.
I have mixed feelings about the modern telling. I mean, like I said, I think I like where they're going with him as an actual alien that we have to wrestle with and his, and that whole phenomenon. But yeah, I have mixed feelings, but at least I will say they finally realized that really thin spandex tights that are brightly colored and easily targeted, not a good idea. So muted colors might be more practical.
So. Right. Well, and it's kind of, yeah, that is one thing. Looking back at this, you're like, even Christopher Reeve, he looks great, but like, my goodness, you know, that's a hard look to pull off. It really is. Oh, man. But yeah, you know, a good movie. If you take it for what it is, and I think it is very much one of those movies, as you said, it's not perfect by any means, and it's certainly not better than Superman 1. You could argue not better than Superman 2. Yeah. But if you take it as, okay, you know, forget the sort of the serious stuff, and we are just going to make a comedy that happens to feature Superman and also has a bit of sort of depth of emotion and humanity in it as well, then, yeah, you know, this is actually a pretty good movie. It will make you laugh. It is entertaining as a Superman story, if you don't take it too seriously. And it has great performances from all of the actors. Even the minor parts, you know, Vera and, I can say, Pamela Stevens' character, whatever her name was.
Lorelei was her name, yeah.
Lorelei, right. Oh, another L, right. Jimmy Olsen, they're all just, you know, everybody is good in it.
I thought that the actor who portrayed Webster did fine. I was a little bummed. Like he did not feel like the big villain. It really felt like the technology that people weren't controlling was the actual villain that was unfolding in this whole thing. Like we made a mistake. We got the wrong kryptonite, and now Superman's going bad. Oh, we made a mistake. We built a big machine with missiles, and now it's going to attack us.
Right, he was just the foil to sort of get those things moving by having the money and having this sort of the megalomaniac who wanted to take over the world.
Exactly. Yeah. And he gets criticized as, well, he was no Lex Luthor. And I agree with that. And I think that's part of the, that seems to be what they were trying to go for. He wasn't an all-knowing, or he did not know what he wanted. He was basically a more powerful Gordon Gekko. He just wanted stuff. He wanted things. He didn't care how he got it. He had no real plan. I mean, Lex Luthor, at least, he was going to sink California, you know, this guy. Yeah, he was literally diabolical, and he didn't care what happened. Webster is more like the archetypical, you know, capitalist, you know, guy who stands there, I don't care who's I step onto the process. But he's not actually trying to be evil. He's just really just selfish, you know, and greedy.
Gus, my friend, we're going to teach them a lesson, aren't we?
Mr. Webster.
Destroy the entire Colombian coffee crop right down to the last bean.
The last bean, we...
Right.
But you got so much, you know, like...
You know, a wise man once said, I think it was Attila the Hun, it is not enough that I succeed. Everyone else must fail.
Seems fair.
Gus.
What?
You are going to do this for me.
It's, incidentally, for people who aren't familiar with this movie, it's Robert Vaughn who plays that character, Webster, who, of course, you know, Napoleon Solo in The Man from U.N.C.L.E., but also, you know, from The Protectors and The Magnificent Seven and, you know, many, many other TV shows and movies, you know, very famous actor. And I think he does a good job with the character that he has. Again, I think, you know, everybody gives a good performance, but I agree, the character is not the most compelling because he does literally just want more power, more money, which is, of course, why it's so funny when Gus asks for a pay rise.
And we just get good old Gus to contact the Vulcan satellite.
Old Gus has been doing some thinking.
Good. That's why I keep you around.
Yeah, I've been thinking that I'm not making enough money for this gig.
Gus, if there's anything I hate, it's greed.
I know. It came across as earnest, this guy.
It worked. But that's the beauty of a character like that, Isn't it? Somebody who's so lacking in self-awareness.
Genuinely creepy and also not really in charge, which I think is the best part too, is that I guess there was some of that too in Superman 2 when Lex was hoping that he could corral these three supervillains. I still don't know. That was incredible, incredible bravado right there.
Right.
Wow. But yeah, that kind of phenomenon. These actual bad guys are a lot harder than to control than we think.
I think incredible bravado is a good way to sum up the character of Lex Luthor. Just overall, really, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Whether that's good or bad.
Criminal mind of our time, whatever.
Yeah. But yeah, as I say, I agree with you. I think this movie is, unjustly maligned. It is not anywhere near as bad as a lot of people seem to think. If you can get over the fact that it's a comedy and, as you say, the sort of fact that the technology makes no sense whatsoever. All right, Jonathan, thank you for joining us on the 4th of July to talk to us about this. Where can people find you if they like what you have to say?
Well, the easiest way to find me right now is on Twitter. My Twitter handle is Jonathan Penn, and that's pretty much it.
All right. Okay. People should go there and follow you on Twitter and argue with you about which Superman movie is best.
I welcome it.
Thanks for listening to Unjustly Maligned. You can check out my comics, books, and music at anthonyjohnston.com, where you'll find information and links to all of my work. You can support Unjustly Maligned by becoming a member of the Incomparable Network. Go to theincomparable.com/members to sign up and check the box for Unjustly Maligned when you choose which shows to support. You can also help by reviewing Unjustly Maligned on iTunes and following us on Twitter at UMPFM. Finally, the show notes for this episode are at UMP.FM. Unjustly Maligned is a 7RQ production for The Incomparable and is made in England. Thanks for listening and we'll see you next time. invisible shield thing, one of the things that the machine apparently is able to like shoot out of its laser orb. The first thing they try is like to encase him in an invisible shield.
To stop him from breathing.
Right. And I'm like, hang on a second. Like, even for this movie, like, we already know Superman can survive in space. We've seen it in the previous two movies, and we see it again in Superman 4. You know, why would cutting off his air supply do anything?
My guess is that, I mean, you heard the villains say that, and the machine is currently in learning mode, trying to figure out how to defeat him. And maybe this is just like, maybe they guessed wrong. Well, I'm curious to know, like, now that you've read the Superman comics after you saw the movies and stuff, have you gotten into Superman more, or do you feel like the comics are not where you?
Oh, no. Well, like I said, I was very young. I mean, you know, we're talking literally when I was 6-7 years old. And I just know I never really got into the Superman comics. I read some of them as a kid. I had, you know, the odd Superman annual. And I would occasionally read monthly, you know, Justice League comics or whatever. But very occasionally, I was never a regular reader. And, you know, I just never got into him as a character. I suppose I'm kind of the modern equivalent of the people who love the Iron Man movies but don't read the Iron Man comics. I would rather watch Christopher Reeve as Superman than read a Superman comic. You know, when right at the end of the scrapyard fight, when Superman throws Clark Kent into the on the conveyor belt on those grinding blades, I could have sworn I remembered chunks of meat coming out the other end at one point, and that's Whoa. The kind of and that's the, you know, that's the sort of he's won, ha ha, you know, and then he bursts out from through the metal and throttles the Superman. But now I'm starting to think, you know, maybe was that a different movie? Have I got it completely mixed up in my head with something else? I just don't know.
Interesting. Well, for what it's worth, it's funny you bring that particular part up, because I remember when he was put in there and he was shoved in, as a child, I remember thinking, like, oh no. And I don't know, knives always scare me. It's that kind of phenomenon, you know, like being cut up. And so he goes through there, and I remember looking specifically to see what came out the other side.
Oh,
and all
really?
I saw were rocks.
Right, so, okay.
At least the VHS version we had, and that was part of like the, oh, okay, he's not dead.
Oh, maybe I am just misremembering it then. Also, I would say a fear of knives is not in any way irrational or illogical.
I wonder too, like, as I read about the history, you know, in the making of the Superman movies book, they go through some of the history of the comics as well. And I found it fascinating that when the comics were finally released, there was a very short, or relatively short, you know, in the span of a couple of years, it transitioned into other forms of media. And then Superman became exploded as, you know, part of the animated series in the 1940s. The serials with George Reeves, no relation to Christopher Reeve, and then it kept going and going until suddenly now we have this was a very serious treatment of a superhero in a film. The first movie was, at least, which I find interesting how that all evolved. Like, I don't know if that's unique in the way, like, in from that era of transitioning so quickly to becoming more than just a comic book character, but it
did happen very quickly. Yeah, it does seem to be, you know, that they tapped into something, whatever it was. Siegel and Shuster clearly tapped into something that people could immediately see the appeal of, because that's the thing, yeah, with adaptations into other media, especially from a pulp medium like comic books, it all comes down to being able to look at the premise and say, oh yeah, I get that, that's interesting, we can do something with that. And that happened, as you say, so quickly with Superman. You know, nobody had to be sort of persuaded or spend years browbeating, you know, the money men into saying, no, this is great. Trust me, the kids are going to love it. Everybody seemed to look at Superman and go, yeah, that's great. Yeah, okay, we'll do that. It's quite extraordinary. And yeah, I think maybe it is kind of unique in that sense.
I also find it strange too how there Superman 1 and Superman 2, then 3, and then it died a horrible death in 4.
Then, oh, yes.
Yeah, yeah. That is completely
strangely,
just...
nobody has offered to come on here and talk about Superman 4, The Quest for Peace.
Maybe I'll offer to, ironically. No, but anyway, but it's strange how, like, we didn't reach... We're only now hitting peak serious superhero movies, which is interesting. Like, it took a long time from then before we started getting into... another swing of people trying to, okay, we'll take superhuman characters and try to make this all happen again. It's interesting that how these things kind of ebb and flow, and Superman kind of broke a mold in Hollywood, but it still took a long time to continue on in that.
It did. Yeah. I mean, you know, and there's all sorts of eras of modern superhero movies, you know, with the sort of Burton Batman movies, and then they died a death, and then you had the X-Men movies and the first Spider-Man movies, and that was starting to felt like it was starting to fade, but then suddenly you got Iron Man and Batman Begins, and it all kind of, you know, it does go in cycles. It is interesting to sort of follow this stuff and see, as you say, how it ebbs and flows.
Now it's hard to find a non-superhero movie.
Right, well, and that's the thing. Now they've taken over Hollywood. I think a lot of it is just to do with special effects. I really think a lot of it is to do with special effects. The minute we reach the point where we can do anything on screen, you know, that was the point where suddenly it was like, okay, actually we can make a comic book superhero movie and nobody is going to say, yeah, but you know, in the comic, you never question whether it's real. And I think the minute we technologically reach that point, that which seems to be around the point of when the first Iron Man movie was made, we just never looked back since. And I am of the opinion that this bubble will burst. but for the time being, at least, certainly, you know, just like the comics industry, they are going to milk it for every cent until they can't.